Hello and welcome to episode 212 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we are coming to you, as usual, from different locations. I'm in Boulevard Park, Washington, home of the Pelton Cast.
And I'm coming to you from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks.
It's been a difficult week in the U.S. in general, and certainly Seattle specifically, as we struggle to make sense of the horrifying video of George Floyd's murder by a Minneapolis police officer, followed by protests here and elsewhere that have met with escalating violent police response. To help us process what we've seen and experienced, we're glad to welcome back third Pelton brother, DJ Infrared.
Hello, guys.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
First off, how are you doing?
I'm doing pretty well. I know that, 2020 is probably, not on the highlight of people in general. But, the first 6 months has been, quite, eventful. And then for me specifically, it was as I was recovering from a stroke that I had in the day after what happened to Kobe. So I had probably, I'd probably say the worst week I had that day at the end of January. But, I've been improving and I'm, getting back 100% and I feel really great and, keep working and hoping to be 100% and, I feel fantastic. So I just wanted to, let you guys know. And it was kind of hard to give people. I know that I probably didn't stop saying anything on Twitter for a month and a half, which was kind of a big thing in my life. But I'm doing great. And, I think that, I've been doing better than I thought I would be. So, it's been a great thing to tell people. So hopefully can understand that, I'm trying to get back to my normal self, which is, when the Seahawks comes, that'll be full 100% letting you guys know how I feel.
Well, we're so glad to hear that.
Yeah.
We definitely missed you on Twitter. Twitter needed you for these moments.
Yeah, I was learning about things, and then I saw what happened, basically at the beginning of March, and I was like, well, no more sports. So it's kind of a good time for me to come back because nothing else is happening. So seems about the first time.
And then everything started happening.
One
of the things that sounds like you've been unable to do as you still are recovering is participate in the protests that we've seen in the Seattle area starting last Saturday.
I think, with me myself, but I think that I would say almost to everybody, it's hard to ignore what's been going around for the last, I'd say week. It's been eventful and it's been something that's, you've seen a lot of people coming as far as, protesting and everything has been going around. It's been eventful. And I think there's a lot of people that are learning that, that are basically saying, they didn't know that this was coming this deep and this, a lot of the things that happened to people was coming really to the fruition. And I think that there's people that were, already built in that and they're basically were bolded and really to go outside and talk about it. And then there's people that would never really talk about that before, but start to realize there's something I can talk about, at home. And this is something, when you think about everything going us on during a pandemic, it's well, I've been at home. How do I talk about this? Because everything else is happening. How does this affect me? So it's been a wild week, and it's going to keep going. And as people, can see what continues to go on.
Absolutely. Have you been surprised at some of the response in these local places where, it felt like early on, it felt like there were police chiefs throughout the country who were sort of taking the personal victory lap when the initial video of the George Floyd murder came out, where they were all able to condemn it right? It's like everybody across the country, it's not a particularly divisive issue. But then as these conversations have started to move locally, all of a sudden we're seeing, you know, you can see video basically in every single major city in the country. There's something disturbing happening, right? And it feels like they were, as long as the issue was far away and it was clear and it was on video, police chiefs and politicians were able to condemn that. But now that things are coming to them locally, it seems like it's been a much more difficult issue for them to respond to. And I know that I personally have been pretty shocked by some of the responses from police forces doing almost the exact same thing that happened to George Floyd in Minneapolis.
Yeah, and I think what we've been seeing for the past week is what happened when basically you had something that was, you know, singularly happening in Minneapolis. And we saw basically how things started to, you know, grow there. You had people going out to, you know, marching and protests and things like that. And then you start to see kind of like things grow from that as far as like through the police and things like that. So then people want to essentially say, we agree with you, we are, you know, with you, and we're going to do our own thing and do that in our cities and things like that. And then you would see with police basically do the same thing. And it was just like a back and a forth. It was like, you know, it was like, you know, it seems like it just grows, because what you basically have is someone feels that the police go too far, then there's a reaction that people feel and they want to, you know, protest and talk about that. Then people, again, policely see that and they want to overreact again. And then you see other people in, you know, about basically around the U.S. doing the same thing. And then police do the same thing there. And so now it's like what happened in Minneapolis a week ago is now it's in LA, it's Seattle, it's New York, it's, you know, San Francisco, it's in Idaho. It's a lot of places where people didn't know that things were growing, and people were, you know, trying to show that they were solidarity with them and trying to, you know, support them. But then things started to happen to them, and then people we're trying to say, well, we're seeing the same thing that happened to us that you guys were happening to you. And now people need, you know, support on that as well. And it's just it's not the first time this has happened. And, it's something that continues to happen over and over again. So we're seeing now something that's, you know, a week, you know, now. And it's like to see it's been seen to me, you know, come into, like, especially with Seattle, to do things as far, like, they haven't done since WTO, which was, like, over 20 years ago, and things like that. Which are, the amount of people come out here, and you're seeing everything when it comes to, you know, riots and protests and back and forth, and we got, like, to think that the National Guard can go anywhere they want to in the United States, like, you know, like, to be anywhere, you know, like, you know, I live, you know, while I was recovering, I was in Snohomish, and there was people from the National Guard against people that were in Snohomish trying to support everything that they were doing. And it was like, this is everywhere. And it's, you know, and it's amazing to me because, you know, when we go back to talk about, you know, the pandemic and everything like that, one of the things to talk about is, you know, kids haven't been at school since March. So yesterday, and, like, you know, even back to Sunday, I saw large amounts of high schoolers, mm-hmm. you know, going and talking about what they were trying to, you know, support or how they feel or anything they want. And we're seeing so many larger people say, we're not doing school, we're not doing regular work or things like that. Everything that we've basically been at home and we've on TV and we've watched and we've learned and it's been such a quote unquote larger amount of people that you're seeing the reactions being, you know, amazing to watch. It's incredible because there's a lot of things where you've got, you know, kids and older people, and it's just like it's thing that, like, you know, I normally wouldn't necessarily see would be immediately as a, you know, to join, but there's so many people and it's, there's so many different things to, you know, affect what's going on. It's really like, you know, how do you, you know, stop, you know, how does someone say I'm not going to do it? And so like, even me personally, I'm seeing like, you know, celebrities and sports talk about something you would have never would have thought they would talk about, because what else are they going to talk about?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it's also fascinating, like, you know, third Pelton brother Ben Baldwin pointed this out on Twitter today after Drew Brees' comments, you know, whether he understood, you know, why players would kneel if they do so when the season starts again. He says, I will never agree with anybody disrespecting the flag of the United States of America or our country. And, you know, this is this, a similar thing to what he said when this first was an issue with Colin Kaepernick in 2016, except now he's getting like widely roasted for these comments. You know, we're in a bubble to some extent, I think, but it seems like the center on this issue has moved where, as everyone has joked about, now all of these major corporations feel compelled to make statements denouncing systemic racism. And I don't know necessarily how that translates into action or meaningful change, but it is fascinating to see how quickly that has changed.
Yeah, and it's been fascinating to me because I've been seeing, you know, it's funny because, you know, I would say maybe like a few years you see athletes be feeling okay saying, you know, I want to talk about this. And that's something that, you know, for a long time, that was something they kind of walked away from. And then you'd have people who would, you know, be, you know, the outlier as far as like, I'm going to talk about this. And then people get shunned. And, you know, if you talk about in the 90s with the NBA, like the Craig Hodges and the, you know, Mahmoud Abdul-Raouf, and those guys would say something and it would be hard to see them talk about it because it was so unpopular and it's uncommon. But now you see the last week, you've got guys like Ryan Tannehill saying something. You've got the kind of the one that has like, you know, it's been like, you know, surprising in a good way was Russell Wilson. And for him to say, I don't want to talk about anything about football. I want to talk about what happens to me, how things, you know, feel me and how it affects me and things like that. Talk about, you know, the thing he talked about happening to him after winning the Super Bowl. And like, yep, he was like a month or two dealing with an insulin and think like, you know, talking about, you know, all of that. And to see him say, I want to talk about this. I do not want to talk about football at all. To see that is fascinating to see him see, okay, I'm going to talk about this, and maybe some people will be okay and not ready for that, but you're going to feel more players, you're going to see more everything be okay and talk about with that. I remember when I actually was a part of a Black Lives Matter, I think it was 2014, that we did at, you know, the Seahawks, you know, it was right at the beginning and, you know, like Richard Sherman and Michael Bennett were talking about things and we did, you know, a protest, you know, outside of the Seahawks game on Sunday. And there was a lot of people that were not happy about any kind of a rally. I think if that happened this year, there'd be a really different amount of people that were unhappy that be there about, you know, there's still going to, you're always going to have people who are not agreeing with what you do. So that's okay. But I think that a lot more people are saying, I'm not away from that. I'm not, you know, shunning that away. And you're going to see more players and even to the state of like, to see how like the NFL or the NBA, how coaches and how GMs and people that are beyond just the player, right, who talk about that is something we wouldn't see normally 5 years ago. But that's something we'll see about now. And so when you realize that people are having those conversations now, when you re-earn the idea of, okay, now games are going to go back to being played, you know, how does that affect what it talks about on a sport level? What does football look like when, you know, if they try to say we're going to start, you know, in September, like everything normal is, how does that affect what's going on when that happens? Especially with what's happened with the past week, you see a lot more people that are, you know, they're basically not afraid to have that maybe they were 5 years ago, not necessarily because it was, you know, they're trying to, you know, condemn it or anything like that. They didn't want to have that. They were really going to just say, I want to talk about basketball. I want to talk about, you know, football, basketball, baseball, mm-hmm. whatever.
Stick to sports.
Yes, stick to sports. But now you're seeing, you know, hate, you know, basically like the head coaches, the GMs, the owners. These guys are really okay to say, let's actually talk about it. And that's something that, you know, 5 years ago, I wouldn't be great about that. But now it's like, let's really talk about how can we change things? How can we, you know, and I know a lot of that is, you know, to kind of put it, you know, singular, but a lot happened. What happened with Colin, it really changed the way that everything happened afterwards, to where it's okay. We're not going to pretend like this is something that doesn't, you know, that a 22, 23 year old, you know, person feels. Someone that isn't, you know, ready to talk about things, you know, and you see guys that are, you know, I remember what, you know, DK Metcalf was like, we're going to talk about this, you know, mm-hmm. That's something you would never see in, like, you know, a second year, 10 years ago, 5 years ago, something like that. But, you know, in 2020, they're okay talking about that. So let's actually have a conversation.
Well, and I think, I mean, I guess my concern is that, like, the court of public opinion, corporations, Instagram, Twitter, like, seem pretty unified on this issue, right? And I think people are pretty clear on, like, being anti-racism and anti-inequality in policing. But I still have this concern where we see these cities throughout the country, and it's like, I feel like everybody is learning individually that this is not about one bad cop, right? This isn't, you know, you can see videos from today of police in New York beating protesters, right? This wasn't the one cop or four cops in Minneapolis did something wrong. This is a systemic issue. And so the thing that worries me is, how many bodies do we have to lose in service of this, like, progress in the court of public opinion, you know? So, like, I mean, you earlier tweeted about, like, about Sean Monterosa, right, outside of from Vallejo, or like David McAtee from Louisville. These are just people this week that have been killed by police because of things that they've done. And it's like, how many of these do there have to be to sway, to have actual systemic change? And how important is sort of that cultural change in changing how police unions function and how policing works on a systemic level? Because I think we can all agree that the general public and the court of public opinion are unified in thinking that this is bad. But, like, where's the point where police officers start thinking it's bad and where mayors start actually having the clout to say, turn on your body cameras, right? Something as simple as that, or don't use tear gas against peaceful protesters. And that's the part that's really concerning to me, because it has been, it's partially, like you were talking about, seeing young people out there protesting and seeing such a unified front, and it's encouraging, but at the same time, there are these pieces of what's going on that are so deeply disturbing and are so uncomfortable to watch. I mean, I know myself, like, I'm sure a lot of other people in Seattle, and maybe you also, and Fred, are watching from home people in the city of Seattle protesting with this extreme tension. And in the end, it always ends one way. And so far, that way has been with tear gas. And it's like, this doesn't have to be the case. And like Nike can agree on this, McDonald's can agree on this, Lego can agree on this, Ben and Jerry's. But how do we get the police officers to, if it's 11:30 at night, if it's 7 p.m. and they are upset about somebody having an umbrella, how do we stop that part from happening?
Yeah, I think the number one thing is that it's going to require a whole lot of people allowing themselves to listen as people that maybe have, you know, more, you know, knowledge or, you know, things like that will say, this is how deep it can really go. It's not going to be just one thing that happens. It's not going to be, you know, oh, this only is going to happen here or there. And it's just, they're going to realize how all this stuff can really, you know, work together against how people feel every day of their life. You know, how it's just like, you know, oh, only a few bad apples or things like that. It's how does this feel the entire time when you feel things like when Russ feels that thing he happened a month after the Super Bowl? Why did that happen? What causes that? Why are people still in, you know, well beyond, you know, the, you know, 275, 300 years we started this country with? How do people still feel like they receive this different type of way because of how I look or because how people, you know, I'm lesser because of who I am or because of something like that? Why? What has become of this? And then how do we fix it? How do we get better by this? And I think that the best way to start is to listen and to understand. And at that point, you'll basically be able to say, I'm not pretending like what's happening to you is something that doesn't happen to me. It may not be something that like occurs to me because I'm a different race or a different, you know, whatever, but I can say why this happens. I can say why they're treating other people who look in different ways. Why is that not the same? And when we start having those actual conversations and more people are trying to say, okay, this isn't something that just happens to them or other people, and it understands why it goes deeper and why it can really affect everyone. And, you know, things that, you know, people, I've seen more and more people understand that nothing, you know, directly that I'm doing or changing, but why feel like basically why all of that, you know, basically, you know, lifts up my entire life and I haven't done anything, but because I don't get, you know, the way that a police officer, you know, deals me or, you know, a restaurant owner feels me differently. How does that help me when I'm not getting, you know, I'm not taught less? So why is that help me out? And then how can I fix that? How can I say that's not okay? How can I help you out? How can I understand that I'm at a higher place than you are? How do I help that so that we're more even out? And how do I do that? And that, I think, can happen with a lot of the conversations and a lot of the dialogue and all that stuff that we've happened, because we've been basically told we can't do a lot anything else for the last 3 months. So what can we change and figure out what makes us different? If we all have to tell people we can't go out, why are we different because of that? And then at that point, a change can really happen. So I feel like I've heard this before, and I don't try to be like, a Debbie Downer or anything like that. But I just try to be, I always try to be, you know, hope that I can say we're trying to change things, but I've seen that happen before and it hasn't really fruition to anything. Mm-hmm. Maybe it can happen this time. Hopefully it can happen this time. We're seeing more people talking about it, you know, whether it be athletes, whether it be musicians, whether it be people everywhere. The more times we see, like, you think maybe it'll be different this time, and you hope, but you don't know. I don't know how, you know, I don't know how the trial of, you know, Minneapolis will end up. I don't know. I that's not gone out the way where people feel it should go many times before with Roddy King, right, with, you know, George Zimmerman, and like, we've been there before. So how do we, like, how do we know that that's not going to happen again? How do we avoid, you know, repeating the same thing over and over again? How can we be better beyond so happens in, you know, not just what happens in Minneapolis, but, you know, every time when we say that something is different, us, how do we say we want to be different and actually be different instead of just saying, well, this week we'll do it, and then something else will happen, you know, after that. And it's just like, you know, when someone thinks about it, and especially, you know, when you talk about 2020, then, like, I remember so many different things changed in just a 6 months of 2020. It's mind-boggling. I'm like, you know, I remember things they were, you know, over this in January, and then something happened in February, and then something happened in March. And it's like, there's always something changing. So how do we make something that is last longing? How do we something that is not going to be short, then, you know, by September, you forget about it, and then we basically just wait until the next thing happens? Or do we do something and says, okay, we're actually going to make the change. How can we do that? And hopefully that conversation can happen, because nothing else can happen right now.
Absolutely. No, I mean, I think a lot about is how policing happens in these individual cities any different today than it was in 2014 in Ferguson? And yeah. I think that you can't answer that question and say that it is ultimately, because we still have, I mean, we have budgets being approved in cities throughout the country where police forces are getting more than in progressive cities throughout the country, where police forces are getting more than 50% of those budgets. And it's something that I feel like I don't remember conversations about that happening in 2014. Maybe I wasn't paying attention, but it's like, these are the things that are actually lead to systemic change. And I don't know if this message gets, if it's 1 week and then we just lose the thread or whatever onto something else, if it's going to lead to systemic change. Obviously what happened in Ferguson didn't lead to national protests in the same way that we've seen here, but it's like, it needs to be, like you're saying, it needs to be more than 6 days of protests. It needs to be however long protests need to happen to make real change at the city budget level, at the policing level, at the process level, to actually change things. For you, as far as, there are a couple of different mentalities. I know we've seen a lot of press for the Campaign Zero recently. We've seen a lot of folks saying defund the police completely or severely less fund the police. Is there one of those that stands out to you as, like, as something you think would be a long-term solution to this?
You know, I think I would basically have to say that the defund police thing, I've heard it talk about more and more this week than people. I know people that will always talk about that stuff, and I've always been agreed as far as, like, these are the ideas that I think about that. But I feel like more people have talked about that this week than I ever really talked about, you know, before. And I think for people to understand it, all you have to say is, when we talk about what happens on Capitol Hill or on Westlake and things like that, and you think about one side and the other side, you have a bunch of guys who are there, who are, they're young, they're not armed with anything. They're basically holding up signs or anything like that. And then the other side, you see police in full riot gear. And then you start, you kind of think to yourself, like, why is that okay? Like, why can that not change? Why is that okay for the police to arm about that. And it's not like a couple people. We're talking about like literally hundreds of people. And why? How is that possible? And when you realize that, you know, like for Seattle, I believe that I think $210 million a year. Why? And figure out what do we need to do that? Why is that, you know, the status quo? How can that change? And then how can we do that to change what police look like when someone says, you know, we saw a police with, you know, the brutality or the killing of someone by the Department of Police. And we want to say, we're trying to, you know, basically say we're trying to protest and talk about that. And every time that happens, the police comes with the most, you know, fully armed, right geared, everything. And it's just like that, without them actually doing anything, they already changed the narrative of how they feel about seeing all that. Mm-hmm. There's no way you can feel, you know, safe with all that. You can't feel like what you're doing here is, you know, a positive thing. It's an important thing. And it over and over, it happens again and again and again. So the idea to say, well, we need to defund the police. We basically have to reduce the amount that these people, like, are basically, they're living and they're using. Why? How do we change that? And how would, at that point, say, we're seeing to have a better conversation, a better useful change that could really, it could basically, you know, you can see an impact that goes long term. And that can really change and spark things that need to happen. And so I know that a lot of the people that I had never heard that really talk from them, because they weren't as, you know, I they weren't the same as my friends that were always about it, or a lot of them were the people that were, you know, the ones who basically started the idea, who were, you know, a lot of the people that said, you know, join us and let us to us talk about this. They were like, yeah, I actually can do that as well. I've learned about that. I agree with that. And can we maybe say the protest of, you know, or the is great, but what's the solution? What's, you know, what can we really do? Like, you know, that hasn't been working before. What can we change? And I think this is something that is not, it's not something that is like, you know, radical, or it's not radical, or it's not, you know, something that is like far-fetched or anything like that. This is something we can do, and we can start right now, and we can see how it can be changed. So let's do it. And, you know, sign the petition, you know, support the rallies and be to say, like, I want to talk about this. And that's going to start every time that's happened before, you know, and we can figure out what has changed. You talk about, you know, things as far as like, you know, civil rights and Jim Crow and things like that. Those things have to change by the same way to say, we need to change this. $210 million a year for the police is too much. We need to reduce that, and we need to do that towards people that could use that at a better way, and we could improve the quality of everything going around with that same people. Absolutely. Okay, let's do it. So
I police feel like they basically are providing almost to this is a Nick Licata line. No public good for a city, right?
Yeah.
Like, very little good comes out of spending more than half of your city's budget on police. And even I think about it, you know, not to bring it back to basketball, but like when there was that conversation about an arena being built in the city of Seattle, which would provide public good for the citizens of the city of Seattle, it was always Nick Licata saying, well, money should be going to museums or whatever. It wasn't take that money from police. And it's like that has been off limits for I don't know how many decades. I honestly have never even heard the conversation. And yeah. I feel like we're hearing it a lot more right now, where it's like, It should be off limits where we're talking about taking money from schools and from places like that. Like from what, we, the there's homeless? So much money to go to homeless, to mental health, to public services, to parks. Like the things that could be paid for with, I mean, we see LA as a city where it's a hell of a lot more than $200 million, and so much of it is going to policing. And it's just like, what are we doing here? As if you were to draw up a society from scratch, you would never, ever draw it up that way. Like, it would be an equal and small chunk that goes to basically policing. And I think that the defunding is a huge part of it. Having officers who are living in the cities that they're working in, I think, is another huge part of it. The idea that we're having officers come in from the suburbs and then working in these cities that aren't their community, I think, is a huge problem. But I think at the core of it, it's just, it's too much money going to something that provides very, very little public good.
Yeah. And I agree. I think, but, you know, when you think about things, you know, on a macro sense, if you feel like you basically say, I can identify this is a problem and this is how we can fix it, all I can say is, then let's fix it. Let's honestly fix it. And then from there, we can see how the different things that we can do because of that, we can improve. And I know that people have been, you know, we're talking about, you know, how homelessness in Seattle has been a really, you know, a hot, you know, topic, you know, the past few years and things like that. Or we talk about, you know, how the amount people pay in rent and things like that. Like, all these things have always been talked about with other people. But if you come to, if you can say, you know, I have a whole bunch of different things happen, but I don't know how to really, you know, come with solutions. I'm like, well, we can come with one. We can come with this one, and then maybe at that point we could talk about other things, you know, down the line. And so hopefully we could talk about it. Let's really, you know, understand that, you know, what happened last Tuesday and what happened to, you know, George Floyd, how do we use that to say, this is enough, this is how we be different, and then really do something long term and not something that will fade away in 2 weeks, 3 weeks, and then something else happens. And that's what I don't want it to happen. That's what none of us really want to happen, because it happens too much already. And it's time. And there's really, why not? There's really, we kind of have run out of that point where we can say, well, there's this reason you can't do it, or no more. Why not? And then get into it and really figure out what can we actually change things. And I hope that I hope we can basically say, this is where we're going to no more. We're going to pivot and we're going to try something different. I hope that's what we do. I hope we don't have to fade in 3 weeks and then wait for the next time something happens, because, you know, I'm 35 years old and I've seen it all my life. And, you know, I would love to see something different, and hopefully it happens.
I do think one key difference between now and 2014 is that it seems like a lot of the talk on social media is not just the generic thoughts and prayers, but it is a lot of people talking about specifics. And, you know, Tristan mentioned Campaign Zero earlier, and that was something that really spoke to me when I came across it, because, you know, number one, it's a lot of data-driven solutions to, you know, reducing police shootings, you know, which is ultimately the goal here. And then number two, one of my questions I had is, you know, we see on the other side of a lot of these issues, you know, there's these powerful super PACs and these groups that are really influential in holding politicians, you know, accountable for making sure that they do enact the changes they want. And, you know, that same kind of organization didn't seem to exist, you know, on this issue in the past. And that's something that I think, you know, the way that they have laid out the eight can't wait, a number of tangible, you know, very achievable things that have been done in various places around the country, but just are not uniform. I think that, you know, gives people a solution. Another thing Doug Baldwin has been tweeting about is advocating the Ending Qualified Immunity Act, which was sponsored by Michigan Representative Justin Amash. First introduced by the U.S. Supreme Court in 1967, qualified immunity shields law enforcement officers from lawsuits when they do not knowingly violate the law. So, you know, if we were to end that, it would make them, in that sense, you know, more accountable, have to deal with the impact of their actions.
Yeah, and you know, it's something that I feel like, as you know, as you say that things are better than they were, you know, 2014, and then when we say that was better than, you know, 2007, and you think about, like, you know, Trayvon Martin and things like that, and 2011 and things like that, like, I always feel like there's these times where we can be better and we can be better, but now I'm starting to see things like, you know, what we talked about with, you know, with Doug, and, you know, things that, like, Michael Bennett and like things that we saw were we a lot of people were just like, those are Seahawk guys, and I was fans of them. But then they kind of show that they're more just a football player. They can do something and really, you know, they can spark the change and really have a real conversation about things. And, you know, I know a lot of people were trying to avoid it, you know, when Michael Jordan had his, you know, his 10-part series about everything like that. But something that we saw with Jordan was that he was really trying to avoid everything he could and talk about that. With LeBron, he's taking everything full force right as he can. And I remember that from before people felt okay when he was doing that with, you know, to make the Miami Heat do what they did for Trayvon in, like, you know, 2011. That was unheard of 8-9 years ago, and now everyone feels okay with it. But, like, to see someone, you know, be that big, to say the, you know, face of the basketball right now, I'm going to do this, and you know to continue those kind of things, and you know, to, you know, put the money up and say I'm going to build and I'm going to do my own, like, my school and things like that. Like, these are things that, you know, I'm seeing everyone say, we're not going to just want to talk about it. We want to put it into action. And so it feels great that every time that we talk about something, we can think about how was Doug trying to, you know, help everything out, and how was, you know, with Mike, you know, Bennett, and things here. And these guys are, like, so many different things, and it's like, let's really put these, you know, he was trying to, you know, he was basically trying to help out, you know, the youth. Let's help people that are older that can change things beyond just what happens in the school level. Let's do it in the vote, in, you know, the way that they can do things in 20 and beyond just being teens, and they can say 20s and 30s and things like that. How can we actually change things? And that's something else that we can do, and not say, oh, it's just, like, you know, it's something that's, you know, there's no names or no one, you know, about this or anything like that. These guys retired, and then they basically say, I'm not just, like, you know, I'm retired and, you know, I'm just playing golf a lot, 36 holes every day. No, these guys are saying, this is what I do. Like, you know, this is what I do now. And you know, and we love Doug as a player, but to see him as what he's doing it now, he's ready to talk about anything that happens. And to see so many more guys like that we just thought about football or basketball 5-6 years ago, when those guys leave the field or they leave the court. Okay, what's different? And, you know, and tragically, when we talk about Kobe, that was a great thing that he was doing. He had an amazing career. And we're like, what does Kobe do afterwards? And we were like, oh, he's so much like, you know, to Jordan and things like that. He was such a, like, he never wanted to lose. He always wanted to be the number one person on the basketball, you know, court. And then when guys were more and more understanding where what Cody was doing and things like that, and Kobe was like, I'm more than that. I'm not just what you think I am. And he was doing so many things to, you know, change and growing. And it was like, it was really sad to really, you know, when I think about it back then, I was like, this guy was really trying to, you know, make a difference. And that's what every time I see a guy retire and things like that, they don't want to just play, you know, they don't want to play golf. They want to make a change. And so let's start really, you know, let's take advantage of that. Let's really say, these guys want to help us. It's time to help. Let's help. And hopefully that's what we're seeing in 2020 and going on, is like, we're seeing guys saying, we're trying to be different than we were 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago. Like, we have the opportunity to do something the rest of my life. You know, these football and this basketball thing is only like, you know, if we're lucky, we get, you know, a decent amount of, but they're like, you know, 8, 9, 10 years. I'm retired on, you know, 30, 31, 32, something like that. What do I do with the rest of my life? Let's see what these guys really want to do. And hopefully that's something that we can help with. And we can basically all together say, we're going to change how things are going. And I really hope that is something we start to see in 2020 and it continues going, and it's not something that fades away. I really, really hope it doesn't. And hopefully that's this will be it. And, you know, I really, really want it to be something really badly. But I know that more than ever before, we have guys that were important. They were, you know, they were famous. They were, you know, they were people who loved them because what they did, you know, at the football field or for basketball, things like that. Now let's talk about what they want to talk about after that and continue doing it. And I'm ready to do that. And hopefully everybody else is, because this is the perfect time to say enough. And I really want it to be that. And hopefully we can follow through with it.
Absolutely. Yeah. We're a fan of Doug Baldwin or Russell Wilson as a football player, but we really love them as people for what they're willing to do and put themselves out there.
Yeah.
You know, along those lines, I think as the Pelton Cast, we wanted to also show that we were willing to put donations behind some of these thoughts. And so wanted to mention that we were going to be donating to, again, as we've done in the past, Doug Baldwin's Family First Center, located in Renton, and then also Black Lives Matter Seattle, as organizations that we really believe in what they're doing. And I know that Kevin also has donated to the
Campaign Zero
as well. So,
yeah. And that's something that I've been doing as well. And it's just really, I want people to understand, like, if it's $25, that helps. You don't have to, you know, like, you don't have to, you know, put a lot of money. Like, I don't want you to think about that. I just want people to say that, like, hey, it's okay. I believe what you're saying. Here's $25. I want to help. And as people, we see that more and more. It's not necessarily about how much we can help. Just to kind of say, I want to help, period. And then from there, I think we can see the real difference start from there, and not just like, oh, you know, I support you, but it's from afar. Now I can actually do that. This is how you can do it. And hopefully, you know, they hear about everything that, you know, that we mentioned, you know, before, or they know another, you know, person or something else where they can help out, and hopefully say, you know, I want to help my parts. How do I can do it? And hopefully we can provide the answer with that. And people can say, I'm not just going to talk about it anymore. I'm going to change. And how do I start? And hopefully this will be the first step.
Yeah.
Great. And then I guess lastly, also wanted to mention, you know, I honestly am not that familiar with the organizations, but definitely want to support Black trans women as one of the most honestly endangered marginalized groups. There's an organization called the Ingersoll Gender Center on Capitol Hill. And then also just the folks who are out there making a change, because the things that have happened through this last week, where what we've seen today with the curfew being lifted in Seattle, this is because of people being out there sharing videos, making donations, pushing on both the police force, the police chief, and the mayor to change the way that they're handling these protests. And then also throughout the country, and we see both the initial arrest of the officer who murdered George Floyd in Minneapolis, and then the subsequent escalating of that charge, plus the additional officers who are there. Like, all of this is because of the work that's being done throughout the country. And I think that's one of the most inspiring things, is seeing how the tangible effects of these protests, because none of that would have happened. And, you know, long term, the thing that scares me the most is that if we didn't have video of this situation with the murder of George Floyd, none of this would have been happening. And so even if it comes down to filming the cops, you know what I mean? Like, that is an important act that is happening throughout the country, and people doing that. And because we have this video, it has incited this important moment throughout the country that we're experiencing. And I think, seeing that has been really inspiring, how things actually are changing and evolving in less than a week. So how quickly that's happening.
Yeah, I mean, I think even in Seattle, just seeing how people felt they were treated in the past week in reaction to what happened to, you know, to George Floyd. I think people have seen that and say, I didn't think it was this bad. I didn't think it was actually happening like this. And how does that, you know, how do I change that? And now we can give them, you know, more, you know, insight to say, this is not something that's like, you know, far away or different, or like, this happened to us, you know, this week. This happened in our city. You know, this is what happened to us, like, right there. And we watched it the entire time. What do you want to do about it? And hopefully that's positive. And so far, I feel what I've heard from people has been amazing. I've been, you know, really, you know, surprised. I've had people that, you know, were not people like I would say they were like, you know, against, but really like neutral about it, or, you know, was not something that they put too much thought about it. But they were like, how can I help? And when we see more of that, I think that's saying, okay, this is really what's going on. This is how you can help. So let's help.
Admittedly, I would put myself in that group where certainly, you know, I was empathetic, wanted change, but didn't do anything to enact it. And Tristan and I were having a conversation, you know, over the weekend, and I hit upon the phrase, you know, that comes from coaching and that Jeff Van Gundy often uses, which is, you're either coaching it or you're allowing it to happen. And I think there were a lot of people, myself included, who were allowing it to happen, even though we didn't want it to happen. So I think changing that is what, you know, makes real change possible. So, well, thanks so much for joining us, DJ and Fred. That was really, really great stuff.
Yeah, we're just sad you have to go and not be able to talk with us about 2012 as well.
It's been really the pitiful, you know, the week that we've had. You know, what you guys do, I know that a lot of people are really, like, you know, the things that you guys do. I know me personally, you guys have been a really great help in just understanding that, you know, when things are you know, different and going through all of these things, you know, knowing the thing that you do, that it's hard to say anything other than, like, you know, thanks. But what you guys do helps. And so I wanted to say thanks to the two of you, because listening every week, it helps. And I know that there's more people that feel about that. And, you know, it's hard to say that on, it's hard to say it on Twitter, like, you know, thank you every week, but this feels like a week where I could say thanks. So I just wanted to say that to you guys. Thank you.
It is literally the least we can do.
Yes. Yeah. Remembering 2012.
Yes.
No. It's literally the least we can do.
Yeah. Hopefully it means something, you know, we get, you know, clowny or something, how something happens. I'm hoping
that would dramatically improve 2020, I think, given how it's going so far.
We just want to hear your thoughts about the Knicks, though, now. All right. Do you want to restart us, Kevin, with talking about the beer that we're drinking this week?
All right, this week's beer from our friends at Elysian Brewing. It's the Salute the Sun Pale Ale, because it was sunny for like half hour today. Pale ale with black limes. This pale ale is conditioned on sun-dried black limes and vibrates with a ridiculous amount of citra hops. Slightly tart, highly citrusy, super chill.
All right.
So, I don't know if he's been a third Pelton brother, but
he definitely has.
At least
I can't pinpoint the exact. He definitely judged something.
Okay. Third Pelton brother Tyler Gardner wrote to us on Twitter last week and suggested that a couple of things. First off, that we try to get the listener to drink along each week, which is going to require more organization than we've had in the past, for sure. But also that we have a rating of each beer based on whether it's better than Rainier.
Okay. I mean, most beer is different than Rainier, if that makes sense. Like,
I mean, his original other scale was all beer is good.
Well, sure, of course. But, like, is this beer better than Rainier? It's just such a different animal Rainier is.
I just think the big thing is that we need to probably come back to the beer at some point later in the podcast after we've actually drank it to review it.
Okay. So we're taking it back to the old school, to episode one, to recording it on speakerphone on your phone.
You always threaten this. It is never. Oh, maybe when we remember 2013, we do have to figure out what we're doing after this week, because this is the last week.
Are we remembering 2013? Are you allowing us to do that?
This is the last week we were originally going to remember.
We're going to remember the Pelton cast.
So please give us feedback on. I mean, we've probably got about a month now that we need to fill, looking at some of the upcoming schedules. But if you have feedback, we mentioned is an idea. We talk about what it's like.
Wait,
to
you're
attend
filling stuff right now? Because this, to me, is what content should be.
I mean, the let's remember some years has been a great filler. Anyways, we mentioned what it's like to attend sporty events. I guess we could do more interviews. There's some possibilities out there. We welcome your feedback.
What it's like to attend sporting events. I don't think that's exactly what we said, but okay.
Yeah, just various different sporting events.
You're talking about working in different capacities of sporting events.
That was your idea. My idea was just like
attended sporting events, but be like, hey, here's what it's like attending a sporting event.
No, I'm not just talking about any sporting event, but I mean like the specific differences between attending a Mariners game at the Kingdom versus attending a Seahawks game at CenturyLink versus attending a Husky game at Husky Stadium.
What about attending like the NFC Championship game at CenturyLink versus attending a regular season game?
But I just think people, there's a lot of, first off, we have a lot of the listener who doesn't live in Seattle.
No.
We also have a lot of the listener who are young enough that they weren't alive to go to the Kingdom. Like, I think these are novel experiences.
Another I think attending a game at the Kingdom might be very different, and it might be attending a game with Jan versus attending a game with Jan.
That's going to be part of the fun of discussing this, is that we weren't allowed to eat any concessions at the Kingdom, which is a good idea.
Do you think we ever purchased a single concession at the entire Dome?
There might have been some like soft drinks. I think that's possible.
I don't remember ever eating a concession at the Kingdom.
Which again was advisable not to eat the concession.
I mean, sure, yes, but I'm saying like we went to. It's not like we didn't go to quite a few games there.
We went to a shit ton of games, technically speaking. Anyways, at PeltonCast on Twitter, PeltonCast@gmail.com, with your feedback on what we should do going forward, whether we should go through 2013, even though we started doing a podcast that year, whether we should go backwards from like 97 or 98, because that's when we started doing the extended ones with a lot of research, or should we go backwards from 93, because that was the first year we did. I don't know. There's a lot of options.
Just whether we should do an extensive breakdown of Chris Smith dating the girl that I wanted to date. In sixth grade.
No, we already did that.
From all angles.
In oral film style.
Breakdown.
Okay, so fittingly for this week, our toasts are pretty much all negative. First off, the 2020 crossover, the Jamal Crawford Pro-Am, officially canceled, I think last week. No surprise here because we're going to talk about there's not an NBA offseason anymore. You can't really have a pro-am without the pros, setting aside that we may not be able to play basketball in Seattle by that point. So, and definitely not in front of large crowds.
Yes, the crossover was canceled. But Waterfallies.
Only postponed.
It was just postponed.
Not officially canceled.
I don't know when Waterfallies would be happening, but.
We'll see.
We're gonna have a Halloween Waterfallies.
Also, we are pouring some out this week for Hall of Famer Wes Unseld, who was the MVP of the Washington Bullets' 1978 NBA Finals win over the Sonics. Obviously part of the 79 series as well, where the Sonics returned the favor and won their only NBA championship. Later, both coach and GM of the Bullets and one of the NBA's 50-at-50 greatest players, who died Tuesday at age 74. In happier news, we have some more listener email.
Oh, really?
So last week we...
This better be international.
It is not international, but it is bi-coastal.
Oh.
Last week we speculated about the listener Chris Wheeler.
Chris Wheeler? I was going to say, is it a follow-up?
It is a follow-up. And a great follow-up it is. Dear Tristan, Kevin, the Horde of Fantasy Geniuses. Should this be like genii? I don't know what the plural is. Thanks for the shout out today on the pod. We are indeed still in Brooklyn, where things got pretty hairy for a while. After nearly 3 months in our apartment, we're slowly going nuts, and our corgi Gary has become a bit spoiled with the constant attention. Now when he doesn't get what he wants, he becomes nearly as loud as his game namesake, presumably Gary Payton. However, we've given notice on our apartment and will begin our road trip to Seattle at the end of June, arriving sometime in late July. We still plan on making good on our promise to buy you guys Rainiers and burgers at Loretta's whenever that becomes safe and legal, and are accepting all suggestions for neighborhoods we should explore living in. Thanks again for the shout and for soldiering on with the podcast without new sports to discuss. Remembering some years has been a welcome distraction from everything else, really. Chris, Meg, and Gary.
Well, I don't know when that email was sent, but things may have gotten a lot hairier in Brooklyn since then.
Yes, I think so. That was last Thursday. There's also a photo of Gary attached. Cool. So I'll have to forward that to you.
This was before people were being trapped on bridges there. we look forward to seeing you in Seattle whenever we can see you.
Absolutely. Okay, let's go through the updates on Return to Play. First off, the NBA expected to approve 22-team format for restart on Thursday, with teams playing 8 games apiece in Orlando, followed by play-in 8th versus 9th matchup if the team in 9th place is within 4 games of 8th. So, how does that affect the Blazers? They are currently tied for 9th, 3.5 games back of Memphis in 8th. And I ran some simulations of this after this came out based on an assumption of what the schedule would look like. It was reported by Vincent Goodwill of Yahoo Sports that basically the NBA will try to take your next 8 games against other teams that are going to be among the 22 in Orlando and then would fill in some. For example, the Blazers, it appears, to make this work, would have to play the Lakers, which...
Oh, God. It is a very strange setup.
It's all very strange. The Lakers may not have anything to play for because they'll have already clinched first, and usually you might be playing for home court in the finals, but that doesn't matter because everyone's in Orlando.
But I feel like with only 8 games, there's no incentive to rest players, right? Like,
I mean, people I think some teams will treat this kind of like the preseason.
I guess so. I mean, yeah, because there's going to be playoffs.
You're ramping guys up.
Okay. Yeah.
If you're the Lakers. Anyways, in those simulations, I used the ESPN basketball power.
We may all be living in a simulation, well, for the record.
That is fine. If so, then someone hit reset, please. Which does not account for the Blazers getting Zach Collins and Yusuf Nurkic back, specifically BPI. The Blazers ended up in the play-in in about 25% of those simulations.
So the most likely teams are New Orleans, Portland, and Memphis.
Yeah, Memphis is overwhelmingly likely to be in there. They'd have to finish at least four games back of two different teams among this group. So it'd be pretty hard for them to fall out. New Orleans is the most likely single team.
Really? Okay.
One weird thing we don't know about yet. So the Blazers, even though they're technically tied for ninth, they have a better winning percentage than the teams ahead of them because they have an extra win and an extra loss. And we don't know whether that will actually work as a tiebreaker yet. That remains to be seen, but that would be if they go have the same.
You lost me there. What?
So they have one more win and one more loss. They're like slightly closer to 500 than the Pelicans and the Kings. So if all of those teams, let's say, went 4-4 in Orlando, it's possible the Blazers would win that tiebreaker by 1/1000th of a point.
Wow. All right.
So, I don't know.
What would the other tiebreakers be?
I mean, just the usual tiebreakers besides that.
Okay. Are they inviting the same amount of teams from each conference? That's what I don't understand.
No. 13 West teams, 9 East teams.
Mm.
He's the only one with everyone who's within 6 games of the playoffs right now.
You know I rep that West. Okay.
I do know that. MLS also headed to Orlando. The MLS Players Association on Tuesday ratified an amended collective bargaining agreement because apparently they hadn't officially ratified the original one. So the owners took the opportunity of the pandemic to create some concessions, but that avoids a lockout and paves the way for the July tournament at the Walt Disney World Wide World of Sports Complex. Teams scheduled to travel to Florida on or about June 24th.
So is the expectation that there's going to be a season as well as this tournament, or is this it?
Let's go with hope. I don't know if I would say expectation, but okay. I think there's a hope that teams might play in their own markets after that if things go well with the pandemic.
Oh, the pandemic.
Yeah, things are going great with that so far. Before then, the NWSL, as we talked about last week, will be the first American sports league back underway. The NWSL Challenge Cup preliminary round schedule was announced at some point in the past week.
Time doesn't exist once again.
Yeah, the OL Reign will play June 30th versus Sky Blue FC, July 4th versus Washington Spirit. They're playing 4th of July against the Washington Spirit. That seems like a tough draw. July 8th versus the host Utah Royals.
Bring it on.
And then conclude their it's not really a group stage, preliminary round, July 12th versus the rival, arch rival, Portland Thorns. The team headed to Missoula last Sunday to hold preseason training camp at University of Montana's facilities with groups still not permitted in Pierce County, their home. Also, French outlet Le Progrès?
Sounds right. Yeah, I took a year of French. I think I know.
On Tuesday,
wait, hold on. Le Progrès.
Okay. On Tuesday, quoted new Reign coach Fareed Benstidi is saying that Megan Rapinoe will not participate in the Challenge Cup. All NWSL players were given the opportunity to opt out of the tournament, and we haven't heard anything from Rapinoe, so it would not be surprising if that is indeed the case.
But in French, Miguel Rapinoe.
On the UW football front, 24/7 Sports quoted Larry Scott as saying all Pac-12 players will undergo weekly COVID-19 tests if they participate in voluntary on-campus workouts that the league is scheduling to begin on June 15th. I don't think, again, those would technically be permitted in Washington as yet, but possibly possibility that could change by then. All players will also undergo antibody testing if they participate. So those are major developments right now. With that noted, should we go back to a happier time?
Okay.
Let's remember some years sponsored by our friends Pagliacci Pizza. It's 2012.
Because Pagliacci Pizza are real ones on the street, just like you would expect. Much respect to Pagliacci Pizza for supporting the protesters on Capitol Hill from their Capitol location, passing out water. Like, Pagliacci Pizza, always with the W.
Of course. Just like...
Pizza-wise, social justice-wise, that is what Pagliacci Pizza is about.
Just like the Seahawks got some big W's in the 2012 draft, most notably in the third round, although the second round went pretty well, too. And the first round wasn't even that bad.
Is this possibly the best draft of all time?
I don't know. The Steelers had some drafts where they got, like, multiple Hall of Famers, too. So I think those are still ahead, but it's...
But the Seahawks drafted at least two Hall of Famers in this draft.
In all likelihood, yes.
I mean, there's one lock Hall of Famer in the draft, but... Yes.
And I mean, Bobby Wagner with the...
Pretty close to a lock Hall of Famer. Yeah, I mean...
Yeah, it's a very good draft. I'm not arguing that.
A very good draft? I'm just saying, is there an argument to be made that this is the best draft? It's an all-time draft.
I mean, I'd have to look at some of those Steelers drafts to really say...
And really, the Steelers? That's what you're focusing on?
Yeah, because they... Okay. All right. Best NFL draft classes.
But not draft classes, individual teams.
Yeah. Best NFL team draft classes.
NFL draft ranking the top 10 team holes of the past 25 years. Well, the Steelers really do come up.
I was wondering, the Cowboys, 70s. Okay. The 75 Cowboys lead this ESPN story. They got Randy White, Hollywood Henderson, several starters, not as many Hall of Famers. It was 71 they got, or 74 they got Jack Lambert, Lynn Swan, John Stallworth, and Mike Webster. That's four Hall of Famers.
Okay.
They won, like, several Super Bowls. They won four Super Bowls in the 70s.
This 74 draft, Lynn Swan, Jack Lambert, John Stallworth, Mike Webster.
Yeah.
And then I'm saying Bears 83. I mean, honestly, like, maybe I don't know history that well, but Jimbo Covert, Willie Gault, Mike Richardson, Dave Dorson, Tom Thayer, Richard Dent, and Mike Bortz.
I mean, these guys made up the core of a significant percentage of the 85 Bears. So, yeah, I think they're pretty good.
But number three, 91 Dallas Cowboys, Russell Maryland, Eric Williams, Larry Brown, and Leon Lett. Like, there's no Hall of Fame quarterback in there.
But it's not like Russell Wilson's the only Hall of Fame quarterback ever drafted. I'm sure other teams drafted a Hall of Fame quarterback in the same year.
I'm seeing of all these draft classes, I am not seeing a single Hall of Fame quarterback. And as far as things that we know, Hall of Fame quarterbacks are the most important thing you can draft.
True. All right. But first, coming off the 2011 season when their defense had really emerged, but they, you know, still were struggling on offense, the Seahawks went out and signed Matt Flynn to a 3-year, $20.5 million contract, and we were excited.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Matt Flynn was like, we see this every year, he was the Week 16-17 superstar.
I mean, he'd started two games in his career because he'd been backing up Aaron Rodgers in Green Bay, and in hindsight, probably should have just kept Matt Flynn.
Probably should have just started instead of Aaron Rodgers.
Went 31 of 44 for 480 yards and 6 touchdowns in their 2011 regular season finale against a playoff-bound Lions team.
And made $20.5 million in that game.
To help the Packers go to 15-1. Okay, so let's talk about Russ going into the draft. So, I don't feel like I paid that much attention to him at Wisconsin, even though I surely watched the
Rose Bowl. Definitely cared. I don't want to be like a revisionist history person, but I remember going into this draft caring, wanting the Seahawks. I'm not going to say that it was like the only thing that I cared about, but I remember thinking like, it was one of those things where you're like, gee, I guess I feel like they should draft that Russell Wilson guy.
Where he really jumped on my radar is the Football Outsiders Lewin career forecast for quarterbacks, which was created by a guy who works for the Celtics now, Dave Lewin, when he was in college, which is kind of funny. He had the highest projection ever for a quarterback in their model, which dealt with quarterbacks who were expected to be drafted in rounds 1 through 3. And so they put an asterisk on him, which it's asterisk season right now, because it wasn't certain that he would be drafted in the first 3 rounds. And then also because part of why he rated so high was he had played so much better as a senior than a junior, and that was after his transfer from NC State to Wisconsin. So it wasn't apples to apples. But also, like, the reason usually they do that is they did the first 3 rounds thing is because you'd get, like, this Texas Tech quarterback who everyone agreed was not good enough to play in the NFL or at least be a starter, but put up these huge numbers in the air raid and, you know, just would come out with this massive projection. I feel like Cliff Kingsbury, of all people, is probably like the platonic ideal of that.
His projection as a head coach. Got it.
Yes. Yes. His projection of his house that he was living in.
Literally, they were talking about the projection of his house during the NFL draft.
Great view of the mountains. But Russ, like, didn't have that. He played at Wisconsin, which is not exactly known for, like, oh, yeah, oh, the gaudy quarterback stats of Wisconsin.
He handed the ball off. He did some things that he's doing in the NFL still.
It was Russ and the guy from draft day were the two quarterbacks who put up big numbers in Wisconsin.
People will show up to Russ's birthday.
They should help. I don't know. Moments, maybe they didn't. Yeah, they would. So that's when I was like, yeah.
CR was there. He was dressed like Batman. It's fine.
That's when I was like, let's get Russell Wilson.
Oh, I'm saying, like, we felt this before the draft. Like, Russell Wilson was, he was one of the players that we had sort of, like, you go into a draft targeting. And the Seahawks didn't have a quarterback. You know, like, we don't do this with quarterbacks anymore, but I'm sure that there have been players since then that we would have kind of, you circle them. And you're like, that's who we want.
We do that with Anthony Gordon this year. Potentially.
No.
Very different. So Wilson's official nickname, the only nickname that Football Outsiders or Football Reference has roasted for him, Pro Football Reference, is the asterisk. And I think I may have been the first person to call him this.
You're taking credit for it?
I am 100% taking credit for it. I tweeted about this.
True shooting percentage. You named the asterisk. And that is not a nickname. It's kind of weird, actually, when you think about it, that Russell Wilson doesn't have a nickname.
No, Russ, it's just his nickname. But I tweeted about it after the
Let Russ Cook is, like, mostly his nickname.
We're going to get to letting Russ Cook.
Wow.
Letting Russ Cook moment.
You're taking credit for Russell Wilson's only nickname.
I 100% am. Yeah.
Okay.
This tweet, April 27th, 2012. Maybe I should search for whether there's an earlier reference to Russell Wilson asterisk. I think most references to it would be mostly people being saying, why is he called the asterisk? I think I've seen that conversation recently on Twitter.
Prior to you?
No.
Or people recently. Are asking that, and then you jump in and you're like, it's because of me, bitches.
I have never said that.
Kevin Pelton, ESPN.com. Russell Wilson is the asterisk. Okay, got it.
All right, I'm scrolling down. I'm at 2013, 2012.
Quote Jason Richardson. Who the hell is Kevin Pelton?
Okay, and I mean, they did mention him as LCF's asterisk in the Football Outsiders article.
And Jason Richardson tweeted, who the hell is Kevin Pelton, and why did he nickname Russell Wilson the asterisk?
But the first tweet here is, moving that we start calling Russell Wilson the asterisk in Seattle.
Wow.
Per at FOA shots in his aberrant NFL forecast.
This is the first tweet?
The second one is field goals 4 days later studying the asterisk. So who, there you go.
That was at field goals themselves?
Yes, it was the headline. Wow. Of us.
Danny.
There you go.
Kate Pelton beat you to it.
He definitely did not follow me at that point. Okay.
He was in fucking Western Washington University at that time.
So the Seahawks quarterback room entering the 2012 preseason.
Oh, my God.
Matt Flynn, encumbered starter Tavarius Jackson, Charlie Whitehurst, and rookie Russell Wilson.
What a just wild group of players.
Isn't it incredible? In the preseason, Russell Wilson goes 40 of 63 for 536 yards, 5 touchdowns, and 1 interception.
There was, I think it was in week 3 that he won the job.
That was at Kansas City, right?
And I remember a throw that he made, I think, to the sideline, where it was like, it seemed like things were headed that way, but it was like, I mean, Matt Flynn going into that preseason he was the starter. This was the year, I think this is the first ever year of, I don't want to say Grantland, but it was the first ever time that I listened to the Barnwell and Mays podcast previewing.
Shouts to the Barnwell and Mays podcast. By the way, Whitehurst was already gone. I actually screwed that up.
Just a colossal failure. But he was San Diego Chargers quarterback, Charlie Whitehurst, at the time.
He was, yes.
But I have never been more centered and focused on a football season. Maybe the following year, but this one, I don't think I've ever really been more focused on caring about and thinking about an NFL team than I was this year.
Except for the opener, because we were busy with the Coruscino Olympics.
It's kind of wild that we didn't watch that game.
I mean,
we literally missed week one of the NFL season.
I think we DVR'd it and like...
We went back and watched it at Katie's house for a little bit.
But like, we definitely watched the final play, or the final drive.
It is actually probably the least amount of a Russell Wilson game that I've ever seen.
I've definitely seen less of games.
That's you. That ain't me, though. I guess maybe seeing... There was the game this year when I was flying back from Oakland, and we were playing Cleveland, but I was home by the second half.
So, notably, you did not... Did you medal at the Coruscino Olympics?
It's fucking bullshit. If we're talking... We don't need to bring up the Coruscino Olympics again, but I had the most gold medals of anybody. Is this true, or is this the previous one? I don't even fucking know. And you all snuck in like darts and some shit later on. Coruscino Games 2012. I had the most gold medals of anybody involved.
Time.
And I did not win field goal kicking and darts, which I was rushed. I had a newborn child. You, notably, no children ever. Chris had no children at the time, as far as I recall. I'm out there, first newborn child, competing in the Coruscino Games with the most gold medals of anybody, and you're giving it to somebody else? Come on, this is bullshit.
I medaled, you didn't. Anyways.
Who gold medaled? I don't need
Michael.
Your fucking... Okay, Michael. Okay. Here, for the record, I don't want a lot of bronze medals. I don't want a lot of silver medals. When they added up who has the most gold medals, that's what they add up, and that's what matters. Thank you.
So the Seahawks ended up losing that game at Arizona 20-16, with Russ going 18 of 34 for 153 yards, including three straight incompletions at the 40-yard line.
Pete Carroll's favorite game of Russ's career.
Oh, no.
Where he handed the ball off. He threw
34 times.
No, he actually didn't end throw it. But I remember this was the beginning of let Russ cook. But we talked about it at the time where it was like, they finally let him go. And there was a period where it was like, they really wanted him to hand the ball off a lot early on.
Yeah. I mean, we're going to talk about this in a second, okay? I've got a plan here.
Okay.
So week two, they crush Dallas 27-7. And then comes the Fail Mary game.
Mm. I know that is the Golden Tate touchdown game.
Yes. The simultaneous possession game. Is how we do it.
Can you believe that was Russell Wilson's third game ever?
A 14-12 win over the Green Bay Packers.
Man.
A stellar performance by the Seahawks defense in this one. Aaron Rodgers, that's 26 of 39 for 223 yards. He was sacked 8 times.
And they wish they had Matt Flynn that day.
4 by Chris Clemens, 2 by Brandon Meebane, 2 by first-round pick Bruce Irvin. Seahawks are then moved to 4-2 after a 24-23 win over the New England Patriots. They beat the Packers and the Patriots in a 5-week stretch.
This was, at the time, this was the best football moment of my entire life. I was there at the Beastquake. I was a fan of the Seahawks before everything, right? I was there in 2005. beating the Patriots in this game, the UMad Bro game, was the best football game at the time, because I hadn't been to the NFC Championship 2 years in a row at that time. This was the best football game I ever attended.
Can you name the three receivers who Russell Wilson threw touchdown passes to in this game?
I want to say Mike Williams.
No, he was not on the team by that
point. Braylon Edwards scored the winning touchdown.
No, he did not. He scored the penultimate touchdown. Doug Baldwin, a 24-yard touchdown in the first quarter, and then the game winner, a 46-yarder to Sidney Rice with
118 left. I was going to say, you didn't even give a fucking chance to say Sidney Rice. Okay, here's the thing, though. At the end of the first half, there was an intentional grounding where Tom Brady threw the ball as hard as he could, just straight through the back of the end zone. And I was like, that is an intentional grounding. And I never thought in a million years that they would call that against Tom Brady of all quarterbacks. And they did. And that was just like, it was a wild moment. But beating the Patriots, when you have things were starting to bubble, right?
And then Sherman with the UMad, bro.
We couldn't see this being at the stadium, but it was like, all of a sudden, Richard Sherman went from pretty good cornerback to one of the most important players in the NFL in that day. I mean, the stage was set for the Michael Crabtree, I'm not going to, like, sorry, receivers or whatever, a year later started in this very second. This was when the story of Richard Sherman started. Was this very game. And for the team in general, it was like the simultaneous possession game was one thing. Beating the Patriots straight up was the most important win in the early stages of this Russell Wilson, Pete Carroll dynasty.
So that game gave the Seahawks so much momentum that they went out the next week and scored 6 points at San Francisco on Thursday Night Football in a 13-6 loss, with Russell Wilson going 9 of 23 for 122 yards and 3 completions in the second half. And that's when the bench Russell Wilson talk reached its crescendo on local talk radio.
Wow, I literally do not remember that game.
I remember watching it at Spitfire for some reason.
Oh, damn. Shouts to Jerry Everard. owner of Spitfire, who we have not dis- wow, where would- oh fuck, me and Chris watched this game together before a Sounders match, is that right?
I mean, plausibly it would have been a playoff match for sure.
Me and Chris were together watching this game, and it was so frustrating. We were at Spitfire for a while together, right?
Were we?
I think we were,
maybe.
Oh, man. Wow. Whew. Okay. Anyway, that was... I actually, now that you mentioned that, remember that game. And me and Chris were watching. I don't know why we were together, but we were all at Spitfire, and it was really frustrating.
The Sounders were not playing, as it turns out.
I mean, that was
also, the MLS regular season is very long. They were still in the regular season.
And maybe we just, for whatever reason, met each other there. But I think we all met at Spitfire.
I think it was partially like not wanting to drive home through traffic for a Thursday night game at that point. Yeah. Anyways, so by that point of the season, Russell Wilson had averaged 7 yards per attempt with 7 interceptions in 7 games. I recall Hugh Millen really vocally supporting Matt Flynn.
Said he was going to eat his hat if Russell Wilson became a good quarterback.
So at this point, I did an analysis of how well Russ was throwing the ball in rushing situations. You're never going to believe this, but they were passing just 39% of the time on first and 10 or second and third in short. But that was by far his best results. And the Seahawks needed to let Russ cook.
This is the Kevin victory lap tour.
Oh, 100%. I've taken so many victory laps on Russell Wilson. Like, oh, people were honestly wanting to start Matt Flynn over him. Like, you can't live that down.
I think if I'm channeling back to my brain 8 years ago, I don't remember us arguing about this, but I do remember. I'm going to give you the W here. I hate to do it. It pains me deep to my core. But I remember being like, maybe Russell Wilson isn't ready for this, and you being like, he is.
He was built for it. So he played better the next week. The Seahawks still lost 28-24 at Detroit to fall 4-4. They then won 7 of their final 8 games of the regular season. The only loss coming at Miami Thanksgiving weekend.
After Thanksgiving. It's funny because they went 7-1 in those games, but the one that I remember the most is being furious about that Miami loss. And the Bears win also. That Bears win was...
The next week. I mean, they were 6-5. Like, that's a crucial win at Chicago. They're down in the fourth quarter.
That was rewatched semi-recently. Is this still happening?
One of the first games. It has not been happening lately.
Yeah. Or, you know, lots happening. But that game, to me, was the moment that...
That was when Russell Wilson became president?
But actually...
Yes.
Not in a joking way. It was like... But it wasn't when Russell Wilson became president. It was when Gus Bradley and Pete Carroll were like, fuck it, we're running the read option.
I believe Daryl Bevel was the offensive coordinator. I don't know that Gus Bradley had that kind of influence on the offense.
Gus Bradley. That Daryl Bevel and... Pete Carroll were like, because it was off a bye, right?
No, it was the week after. The bye was, let's see here, before the Miami game.
Yeah. Okay, so it goes Miami. The bye was in a Thanksgiving week, so we had a ton of time off. Lose that game in Miami, which was really frustrating. I don't remember the game itself, but I remember being really upset about losing. And then the end of that Bears game was like, they have committed to a new offense.
Scored a touchdown with 24 seconds left in a preview of things to come. Gave up the tying field goal in that final 24 seconds, but then got the ball in overtime and marched down the field. Sidney Rice with a 13-yard touchdown pass on a play in which he was concussed and missed some time. That was a really scary play, but an exciting outcome, obviously. Over the final 8 games, Russell Wilson averaged 8.7 yards per attempt with 18 touchdowns and 3 interceptions.
Okay, but we can't not mention maybe the most important game of the first...
We're getting to it.
Oh, okay, fine. Okay, I'll let you get to it.
And Marshawn Lynch thriving with that read option and the Russ keep element, averaged 5.6 yards per attempt over the final 10 games dating back to the San Francisco game. 5.6, like, you should run if you're going to get 5.6 yards per attempt. Run a lot then. So we mentioned the 23-17 OT win at Chicago. A 58-0 win over the Cardinals that we attended together.
That was not the game I was going to mention, but okay.
A 50-17 win versus Buffalo in Toronto.
Remember that one? Very fun.
And then the 49ers on Sunday Night Football on Festivus. This was like, okay, it's cute that you've won all these blowouts against bad teams, but what are you going to do against a real team? A team that, you know, had won been the number one seed in the NFC the year before, right? At least had won the NFC West.
Yes, and we're on their way to going to the Super Bowl.
Although we didn't for sure know that then.
With the new quarterback, Colin Kaepernick.
Yes. The dueling root option in that one. The Seahawks won 42-13.
This was, I mean, like, there was never a more exciting game throughout the city of Seattle. I'm pretty sure this was it. This was, in a lot of ways, wasn't the most important game of the Russ Pete John era, but
it might have been the most fun.
It really was like obviously winning that NFC championship game the year later against San Francisco was the most important game, but like, this was the game, like, we beat the shit out of the 49ers
just start to finish. And the Seahawks scored a touchdown a minute 12 seconds into the game. They led 21-0 a minute into the second quarter after a Richard Sherman 90-yard field goal return off a blocked field goal, which I do not remember at all.
No. The play that I remember was Cam Chancellor destroying Vernon Davis in this game, though.
That is the memorable highlight. I kind of thought that the Pete Carroll, like, Mr. Peanut strut was from this game, but sadly it wasn't. It was from the New Orleans game on Monday Night Football the next year.
Another great one. But, like, this was the game where it was like, this team is not just for real. They're actually, you don't realize this, NFL, this is the best team in the league.
They finished like, number one in DVOA.
Exactly. It was like, other teams may go to the Super Bowl, whatever. This team might not win the Super Bowl. This is, for this season, the best team in the NFL.
That and was they the proved start. It
by, look, there was a close game at San Francisco. Come to Seattle. Not a close game at all. But also, just like December 23rd, heading into Christmas, you cannot have that. Like, God, I wish I had a time machine to go back to this moment. Like,
I mean, I think we all do.
There has. I wish I had a time machine for a lot of reasons, but there has, honestly, there has never been a more fun game that I have been to as a Seahawks fan than this game.
That was the start of their DVOA four-peat, but they still finished a game back of the 49ers in the NFC West because the 49ers won their finale and had to start the playoffs on the road at the NFC East champion Washington Professional Football Team, which also had a thrilling rookie quarterback who we talked about last week, Robert Griffin III.
And really just a bummer what happened to him on this turf.
I mean, the Seahawks, which, by the way, like generally is a very low injury field, FedEx field. Seahawks fell behind 14-0 before RG3's ACL tear and then outscored Washington 24-0 over the final three quarters, but notably also lost Chris Clemens to his own ACL tear in the same game. That would loom large the next week. Traveled to Atlanta, the NFC South champion and number two seed? No, number one seed.
They were ahead of the Niners.
Because San Francisco ended up playing in Atlanta, too.
Oh, yeah.
Went down 20-0 and trailed 27-7 heading into the fourth quarter before scoring three consecutive touchdowns as Russell Wilson went 24 of 34 for 379 yards and two touchdowns.
I wish we would have realized
the portion of this game
at the time just how Seahawks of a story this would have been.
Oh,
I mean, I guess I don't, but like,
yeah, I'm glad we didn't.
This was the most Seahawks. We had no idea at the time. But this was the most Seahawks game ever. And for every, from the comeback to the defensive breakdown at the very end to Pete making a bad coaching decision. Like
no,
this,
Pete did not make a bad coaching decision. It's irrelevant whether you ice the kicker or not. It doesn't matter. That's outcome bias.
If he misses that field goal, if we don't call a timeout, the Seahawks go to the Super Bowl 3 years in a row. But okay.
But he could have just as easily made the first kick and missed the second. Like, it's just complete random noise.
3 years ago.
You're looking at the night sky and seeing patterns.
I just don't exist. I don't believe that the Seahawks, if they were to somehow have won this game, I do not believe that they'd go into San Francisco and lose.
I agree. So they left 31 seconds on the clock after the go-ahead touchdown to give them a 28-27 lead, giving Matt Ryan time to throw two passes and get 41 yards to set
How
up Matt Ryan's
was this,
winning 49.
Who was this on? What happened?
I mean, they had no pass rush at that point because Clemens was out. Like, and guess what? Then they signed fucking Michael Bennett and Cliff Avril the next year. It was a great decision.
It is such a bummer that that happened because to me, this is it's the Seahawks team that I actually care the most about.
Oh, same. It's my favorite Seahawks team because I enjoy the like climb more than I enjoy the mountaintop.
Well, this and the next year are like clearly the two most defining Seahawks teams that have ever happened. But like, because look, the mountaintop includes Cliff Avril and Michael Bennett. which was a lot more fun than rookie Bruce Irvin and Chris Clemens being injured.
This game came out of nowhere. The 2013 team, we expected them to win the Super Bowl. And, like, obviously you're realistic about it, and it's not like we weren't excited, but it wasn't the same as the, like, newness of 2012.
2012 was, I mean, you go from being an 8-8 team to being, I don't want to say.
It's like your first love.
Yeah. You'll find out about that soon. I don't, this was the most important Seahawks team of my entire life. Excluding nobody. They won the Super Bowl in other years. They win the Super Bowl in other years. I have never cared about a Seahawks team more than I did about the 2012 Seahawks team.
I remember being so excited to watch the Pro Bowl because it was just like, this is an opportunity to watch Russell Wilson play football.
Yep.
And any of those are great.
This is the thing. So the football offseason is very long. And I remember the second they lost to the Falcons, it was like, I want to time travel forward to the beginning of the next season. Because it was just like, we knew we had the best team. And this is not retconning. This is not looking back on it like as because they did win the Super Bowl the next year. We knew in that moment that this was the best team in the NFL because they weren't the best team in the NFL in 2013. They were also, but they were going to be. We knew that they were the best team in the NFL in 2012 too, and they just happened to lose a game.
Well, I mean, also they just started slowly. Like it took a while because they had a rookie quarterback.
But like, all right. it was this offseason. It went by like instantly because it was like, bring me more football.
And you were so excited about it. You were like, hey, let's start a podcast.
I mean, literally never at any other point in my entire life have I ever been this excited about a sports team in between the 2012 and 2013 Seahawks teams.
You don't think you were more excited about the 95 Mariners?
No. I was 10 years old. Like,
yeah, that's the point. You were 10 years old. I mean, to me, like 94 Sonics is the peak of it because then they broke my heart and it's never going to be quite the same.
No, this is it. You're wrong. You're just wrong.
You're wrong.
The 95 Mariners were a surprise. If you want to talk about anything, it'd be the 96 Mariners. But like, baseball's different than football. Baseball is a slog.
It's a happy slog during the summer when you're a child and the internet doesn't exist.
It really, really is not. Like,
I disagree, sir.
But when you know that you're a fan of the best team in the NFL, when you beat the Cardinals 58-0 and you and me and Chris Smith are there, drunk as can be at CenturyLink Field, almost getting kicked out.
I was not drunk as could be. So maybe that's a key difference here between like your enjoyment of the 2012 Seahawks and me thinking back relative to my childhood. Alcohol wasn't as big of a factor for me.
We were at Showbox Soto drinking Labatt's Blue. Is that right?
I don't specifically remember drinking Labatt's Blue.
That was like the cheap beer of choice at Showbox Soto in the 2012 season. But picture yourself as me. Was this the year that the DeSean Jackson touchdown happened with the Eagles?
No, I don't think so. I think that was his rookie season, wasn't it?
No, definitely not. Well, I don't know. I won the fantasy football playoffs a lot of years. you cannot be, as a 10-year-old or whatever, 11-year-old, me at Showbox Soto, drunk off Labatt's Blue, every single game, walking in, beating the Cardinals. This wasn't the Seahawks who fucking lost to the Cardinals every single year. We beat the same Cardinals team 58-0.
It was not the same Cardinals team.
But
there's a lot more John Skelton and Ryan Lindley both
the next year. John Skelton and Ryan Lindley could have been there. Quarterbacks of that caliber could have been there for the next 8 years. And the Seahawks never beat
them. On Drew Stanton.
But they never beat them at home like that. And this was a team, they were on a mission.
We're on a mission from God.
I'm just saying, this was the most fun Seahawks team. I don't care that they didn't win the Super Bowl.
You said it like seven times.
I care more about the Seahawks team than I care about any other Seahawks team ever.
Okay, congrats to you. UW men's basketball won the Pac-10. But did not participate in March Madness. It was a week non-conference that saw the Huskies go 6-5 with losses at St. Louis, at Nevada, and overtime, a game where Tony Roten did not give the intentional foul that he was instructed to both Marquette and Duke at Madison Square Garden by a combined 8 points. So both of those were impressive performances. And then most damningly at home to South Dakota State behind a big performance by Nate Walters and Husky's 32-game non-conference home winning streak.
Walters.
The same weekend as the Watch the Thrones concert.
That was the same weekend?
It was. It was a big weekend because the battle in Seattle, Gonzaga played Saturday. I went to that game on Sunday.
Who did they play? Who did Gonzaga play?
I don't remember that.
What, did they play Southern Illinois 1 year?
Probably.
Or maybe Illinois. God, I want to go back in time to that weekend right now. This was bullshit still, though. UW deserved to be in the tournament.
We'll get to that. So the Huskies rebounded against a historically weak Pac-12 that had just expanded, winning the conference at 14-4, but then lost the tournament Pac-12 tournament opener 86-84 to Oregon State, with Tony Roten missing key free throws, though he did have 29 points in that game, shooting 10 of 19 from the field.
Literally probably his best shooting game of the year.
Well, you know, the Tony Roten show, it was, there were highs and lows. Not selected for the NCAA tournament with Pac-12 tournament champ Colorado and Cal, the lone two representatives from the conference. Now you can say this is bullshit.
This is fucking bullshit. Like, if you win the Pac-12 regular season title, that is, you're in the NCAA tournament. That's it. There's 64 teams at the time.
They might have already been up to 68 by then.
There's 68 teams at the time. Winning the Pac-12 regular season is worth being in the NCAA tournament. Whether you miss a couple of free throws in the Pac-12 tournament does not matter.
They were 56th in KenPom that season. And that, it doesn't matter. In the NIT, where they were the number one seed, won three games at Heck Yeah against Texas Arlington, Northwestern, a game that we attended. I mean, I went to all of these.
Did I attend that?
I think so. Hmm. I think you and the famous Cousin Katie both went. And then most notably in the quarterfinals against Oregon, a 90-86 win to return to Madison Square Garden for the NIT Final Four, where they lost 68-67 in overtime to Minnesota in the semifinal.
I remember when Roden missed those free throws, I was at a Vera Project retreat. And I was at Doe Bay watching it on my phone. Literally nobody else cared. And I was like feeling fairly devastated, but being like, they'll still make the NCAA tournament. It doesn't matter. It's fine. They won the Pac-12 regular season. And we like Tony Roden. Like, I like Tony Roden as a basketball player. It just... What do you want, right? Like, Tony Roten is a homegrown basketball player. His family is deep in Seattle history. Like, Mrs. Fantasy Genius worked with his dad as security at Renton School District. Like, Tony Roten is part of who we are. And
Gary Bell could have been part of who we were, too.
Fuck that. Gary Bell
would have stayed for 4 years.
No, that's bullshit. Tony Roten was an NBA player who just, he never quite had, like, the chops of being, he was always flashy enough to be an NBA player, and he never was fundamental enough to be an NBA player, which is like, he would make some thrilling plays, but he was like the anti Brandon Roy, you know. Brandon Roy was so fundamental and could do everything as an NBA player. He didn't do anything that thrilling. Tony Roten made some amazing plays.
He's so good at rebounding his own misses at the rim.
He just wasn't as a consistent player. I think Tony Roten's whole career could have been different if he stayed another year at UW. But at he was an NBA player. Like, and he had to take a shot at the NBA. And ultimately, like, what he was able to contribute to a team could have been a thing that could have dominated possessions for a bad team, but he just didn't have...
The Philadelphia 76ers.
He didn't have the game to be a consistent NBA contributor, and he couldn't find his role.
Also, but, Tony Roden, he coined the term "trust the process."
If I could spit out my drink, I would. Before Embiid? Roden?
Yeah. Oh, 100%. Tony Roden came up with that phrase.
You're saying, you're coining terms? You're saying the asterisk? Tony Roden is coining trust the process?
Yeah.
What is this world we live in?
That's like his lingering contribution to basketball is Tony Roden.
Wow.
He said it in an interview to ESPN's Pablo Torre.
Does the podcast The Rights to Ricky Sanchez know that Tony Roden is the one who coined that?
I'm pretty confident they do.
Tony Roden he never had the game of a winning NBA player. He always had the game of an NBA player who is not going to win games, but is going to take up a lot of possessions and do some exciting stuff. And
I do wonder how different Roden's career might have been. He tore his ACL, I think, as a junior at Garfield when he was playing basketball. Football, I should say. He played football for them as a junior. I remember Joshua Smith, who was the same class, who ended up at UCLA. I think he had a football injury, too.
That was the big man? No.
Yeah.
From Kentwood?
Yeah. It was a big year for Kent. They had Gary Bell at Kentridge and Joshua Smith at Kentwood.
Dude, Josh Smith at Kentwood. He was always undersized, but he was a monster. Playing against UW. He was like 6'8", but he was a beast.
Like, I remember, like, real young Roden, I assume his sophomore year, I think, was when I first saw him.
That was an issue, though.
Electric.
He wasn't polished like NBA players are now. Like, he excelled at things that don't matter in the modern NBA.
All right, UW football.
Wait, no. I have to say the last thing. Whether he tore his ACL or not, Tony Roden, he just wasn't a good shooter. And that was, like, the way that guards looked in the era of him being an NBA player, you needed to shoot.
Yeah. UW football rode the roller coaster that year. They played the season at CenturyLink during Husky Stadium renovations. They lost 41-3 at number 3 LSU in week 2 while you were losing the field goal competition in the Carousel Olympics.
Hey, you know, I had a live tiger there.
I forgot about the live tiger.
I lost.
Then they bounced back with a 17-13 Thursday night win over number 8 Stanford
Highland
by 61-yard Bishop Sankey touchdown on the final play of the third quarter and a game-winning touchdown to Kason Williams.
Leaping over defenders.
With 4:53 left, it was the Huskies' first win versus Stanford since 2007. They lost their next 3 at number 2 Oregon versus number 11 USC. I wrote down UCLA for some reason. And at Arizona because Sark could never win in the desert. And then won their next 4, highlighted by a 20-17 win over number 7 Oregon State. They played 4 top 11 teams that year. It was a very difficult schedule. Before losing the Apple Cup 31-28 in overtime at Wazoo after Travis Coons missed a 35-yard field goal at the end of regulation. It was the only Mike Leach win over UW.
Wow. So Mike Leach never defeated Chris Peterson, but had that one win over Sark.
Sark solidly controlled that matchup too, but had that one loss, which I remember listening to that field goal as I was driving to Portland to go to a Blazers Timberwolves game, and that was a tough one.
Which team was Brandon Roy on?
he was on neither, as it turned out. We'll get to that.
That win, the Kason Williams touchdown with him leaping over to the defender at CenturyLink.
Oh, no, actually, I'm wrong. He was on the Timberwolves at that point.
Us in the 200 level, the worst seats we've basically ever had for a Husky game. That was thrilling stuff. They were in the black jerseys. You remember that?
Yeah. I added it in the notes. I didn't mention it.
That was good shit right there. It was like Kason Williams before. This was Kason before he got hurt, right? Or is this post-injury Kason?
No, I think this was before he got hurt. I think this is his junior year.
Man, Kason pre-injury. He still would have been a great NFL player had he stayed on the Seahawks. But if they had freed Kason Williams, of course. But Kason before the injury, he was destined to be a great NFL player.
So the Huskies ended up facing number 20 Boise State. and some coach named Chris Peterson in the Las Vegas Bowl and lost 28-26 in a Broncos field goal with 1:16 remaining. That score aside, the defense dramatically improved under new defensive coordinator Justin Wilcox, who replaced the controversial Nick Holt. But offensively, Keith Price took a step back, going from 67% accuracy and 8.5 yards per attempt as a sophomore to 61% and 6.3 yards per attempt as a junior.
I wonder what I honestly have no idea what happened. I feel like it's such a Pac-12 story, or just a college football story.
Because his next year would go much better, as we'll get to. We won't get to, I guess. We won't. Go back and listen to the Pelton cast from 2013.
We're getting to. We're doing 2013. Fuck you.
We already did a sports year interview and music year interview.
We did not. Nobody listened to that.
Well, nobody listens to this. The Sounders reversed some trends in 2012. They finally lost the U.S. Open Cup, but actually won a playoff series in the MLS Cup. They once again reached the U.S. Open Cup final, but lost on PKs at Sporting Kansas City with the score tied 1-1 after extra time. Sounders finished third in the West despite the second-best goal differential in MLS at plus 18. They had a high-scoring duo that season of Eddie Johnson, newcomer, with 14 goals, and Freddie Montero with 13, the longtime Sounder. Beat RSL 1-0 on Ariat in the conference semifinals, getting the only goal from someone named Mario Martinez, who has completely been lost to history for me, in the second leg on the road.
Mario Martinez was on the Sounders?
Yeah.
Hmm. Okay.
I don't know what Mario Martinez you're thinking of, but it's not him. Advanced to the Western Conference Championship with home field over the LA Galaxy, but lost 3-0 in the road leg at Carson and could claw back just one goal at home. It was the end of the year in era for the Seattle Storm, who traded Swin Cash to Chicago in January for the number 2 pick used on Shaquita Strickland. They prepped for the first half of the season without Lauren Jackson, who was preparing for her final Olympics with the Australian national team, and started the season 1-7 before recovering. They headed into the Olympics break 9-10, but really, despite Lauren's return, were not that much better afterwards. Going just 7-8 is she was limited to playing nine games and averaging 18.6 minutes while dealing with injuries. It was the Storm's first below 500 finish since drafting Sue Bird in 2002. They still made the playoffs as the number 4 seed in the West in a matchup of the last two champions with the Minnesota Lynx. Won game 2 in double overtime after Lauren's game-tying 3 in the closing seconds of regulation, and then had the ball down 1 with 3.3 seconds left in game 3 at Minnesota. But LJ missed the shot on the final play of her WNBA career, and also my final game as a Storm and boy after 10 seasons with the team. Real end of an era.
There we go. Was it 2012 that you started working at ESPN?
It was the end of 2012. December Boxing Day 2012 was my first story about Austin Rivers having the worst warp in the league.
Yeah, I don't know if that aged well.
I mean, it was true that he had the worst warp in the league. So people think Austin's had a better career than he's had.
You started working at ESPN in the year 2012.
Correct.
And they had approached you, they flew you to Bristol or whatever. This year?
Yes.
Ow!
Yeah. It was shockingly fast. They called me at like 11 a.m. and then that night I was on a red-eye flight to Bristol.
Really?
And the next week they hired me.
Was I living with you at the time?
No, that was 2011. You were solidly in Renton. I remember, Baby Fantasy Genius was born. And I remember Mom and I went over to your house after we went out to dinner to celebrate. And then Baby Fantasy Genius was wearing a Santa hat. There was some photos on Facebook at one point.
We celebrated you being at ESPN?
Yes.
Wow. Okay, let's finish sports. I guess I have to talk about having a baby for the first time.
All right. M's ended in number 2.
Mildly important event that happened.
After 11-plus seasons and 2,533 hits, Ichiro was traded to the Yankees in July as the M's headed to a 75-87 finish, a season highlighted by Felix Hernandez during the first perfect game in Mariners history on August 15th versus Tampa Bay. Fittingly for Felix, it came in a 1-0 win, with the M's scoring the only run in the third inning, and it is still the most recent perfect game in baseball history.
Wait, really?
Yeah, no one has thrown an MLB perfect game since then.
No, that's wrong.
I mean, Wikipedia might be wrong, I don't know.
No. That's crazy, because I feel like there was an era where there was constant perfect games.
Correct.
And this just was the last of them?
I guess so.
Well, the Armando Galarraga game was after?
No, that was earlier. I think that was 2010. They just were talking about SportsCenter the other day.
Really? Wow. Okay, so I'm looking at this and I'm seeing Felix Hernandez is the last one.
Yeah, it was 10 years ago, Armando Galarraga. June 2nd, 2010.
Wow. Okay. Wow.
So, for that matter.
That's kind of cool, actually.
Yeah. Yeah. Good for Felix. Also, the Blazers ended an era. At the end of 2011, after the lockout, they used the amnesty provision to waive Brandon Roy, who announced his retirement, which he briefly came out of to try to play for Minnesota, but I think he managed like six games with the Timberwolves. I guess 2012 was the year I saw him play in the crossover, back when it was at like the Garfield Community Center.
Damn. Before he was the coach.
Yeah, whatever the name of that community center is. And I remember going there and tweeting about his game, and Blazers Edge ran a piece about it. I was very excited at that point, and then that comeback did not last very long. The Blazers used the resulting tax flexibility to add Seattle native Jamal Crawford as a replacement for Roy, and started 7-2 before losing steam and dropping to 20-23 ahead of the trade deadline. They had a busy day. They fired Nate McMillan. They waived Greg Oden. They traded Marcus Camby to Houston for expiring contracts and a second-round pick. And then they traded Gerald Wallace to the Nets for expiring contracts and a top-four protected first-round pick that later in 2012 they would use on Damian Lillard.
Why? I mean, this was obviously a great moment in Blazers history. Oh, and this great moment in Blazers history directly translated to a great moment in Seattle history.
That's correct.
In 2019. Dame Lillard, I love Brandon Roy as a basketball player. Dame Lillard is the most important basketball player in Portland history.
I don't know if I'm going to go that far.
Fuck Clyde Drexler. Like,
Bill Walton won a championship there. Clyde, Dame's not there yet.
Dame Lillard is the best basketball player to ever play in the city of Portland.
Bill Walton won MVP in a season he played like 50 games.
No,
was pretty damn good.
Okay, that's great for your 60s, 70s basketball. Like, come on. Dame Lillard was playing when there was real competition. He was playing a real sport at a real time. And Dame... At least as the impact of basketball in the city of Portland affected the city of Seattle, Dame Lillard is the most important player in the city.
Bill Walton's injury in the 78 playoffs affected the city of Seattle, but that's an entirely different story.
Didn't fucking matter. Team still moved. Having... but the shot that Dame Lillard made in last year's NBA playoffs was like, honestly, there's very little that can compare to that as far as a redemptive moment for the Northwest and basketball.
Well, look, we're going to remember 2019 at a different time.
Let's do it right now.
It's already well after midnight. Should we talk about music? Because we got to talk about the Macklemore moment.
Some of us like to call it the Macklemore moment.
Do we?
No, actually. But this was... So the Versus EP had come out previously. Macklemore definitely leveled up. Like, we've known Macklemore for a long time. Me and Mrs. Fantasy Genius used to joke with Katie and Ben as, like... Macklemore was the dude who would stand in front of us at hip-hop shows, and every single hip-hop show you'd be at, you'd be like, oh, there's Macklemore in front of us, which is like, it's wild to think about now, because Macklemore is a very, very famous person,
But it was like every show you'd be at, whether it was a national show, local show, whatever, wherever you are, Macklemore's in front of you. And obviously I'd gotten to know him as a person, and the Versus EP had come out. He definitely elevated who he was as an artist. And it felt like things were moving in the right direction, but there was definitely a moment. So I went to the thrift shop. It was the first single from The Heist. And they did a video premiere at the Crocodile. So if you recall the thrift shop video, there is him, he's popping tags or whatever. He's at the Goodwill, he's going through the bins. There was like 40 people there, right?
Really?
And, oh, yeah. I mean, you can't... Macklemore wasn't famous. Like, this was not... The way that you're viewing it is Macklemore the famous person. This was Macklemore the local rapper, right? And I remember hearing the song and being like, this is a cool song. But
oh, that video is by my guy, John John I.
Yeah, John filmed the video. It's like Halls is in it. It's very interesting. Like, it was a cool moment. But also, I remember being like, they're swearing in the chorus. I was like, it'll never translate. I distinctly remember saying that. And then by the time the next video came out for Can't Hold Us, the whole world had changed. So the next video came out and he was like, we're doing a party for the Macklemore fan club, a pizza party for the Macklemore fan club. It was a Columbia City Theater. And this wasn't 40 people of fucking music industry people. This was packed at the Macklemore video premiere at Columbia City Theater for Can't Hold Us. And it was like the moment had happened in that time period between Thrift Shop and Can't Hold Us. The moment had already started, right? And so like I went to both of these and it was like, oh, Macklemore matters now. And by the time we were there, it was like, I remember seeing it and I wasn't in the very front. I wasn't one of 40 people. It was like, I was pushed to the back being like, oh, this is kind of weird. There's people in the like snow in the desert in Seattle at like the Memorial Stadium when the Can't Hold Us video happened at Columbia City Theater and that premiere. But this was like the first inaugural Macklemore pizza party. And it was the Can't Hold Us video. And it really was just like, okay, we're kind of feeling that this moment is happening. And then Can't Hold Us hit Cube. And then Can't Hold Us hit national radio. And then,
Can't Hold Us was the first?
Well, Thrift Shop was first. But Can't Hold Us was the one that pushed beyond.
Broke through?
Yeah.
Was it?
Yes. And then we got to October, November 2012, and Same Love happened, and it was just like Macklemore owned the moment, especially in the city of Seattle. I mean, I went to a party at Oddfellows organized by Carrie Harrop, where it was like it was a pro legalization of gay marriage in Washington State, and Macklemore owned that moment. In the city of Seattle, where it was like he had the song for the message that was happening, and I will never forget that election night. Like, I remember 2008 and celebrating in 2008, but I was at home. It's like, this is cool. Were you there? We had bottles of champagne.
I was there, yeah.
Okay. In the Rent Highlands. Like, it was fun, but there were a few of us. 2012. We were at the Comet Tavern, recently reopened, and there was the Macklemore moment happening. There was gay marriage in 2012, November 2012. Obama was reelected. Gay marriage was legalized in the city of Seattle, or in Washington State. And weed was legalized. On the exact same day, all of these things happened. And we went and we partied in the streets on Capitol Hill. It was literally the best day of my entire life.
So again, your child was born in 2012.
I don't remember that very well. I know my fantasy baseball team had a good week. But no, I'm telling you, you cannot replicate
It was a moment. It was for sure.
Obama,
especially in Capitol
Hill. I'm at the Comet Tavern and seeing on TV, being like, we're projecting. I'm watching Anderson Cooper or whatever. And they're like, we're officially declaring. Because the TV network's carrying a lot of weight in declaring things, right? And they're like, we have declared that Barack Obama has won the election. And they're like, in the state of Washington, it was like, gay marriage has been legalized. Marijuana has been legalized in the state of Washington. All of this happened the exact same fucking day. And we went outside. I was at the Comet Tavern. Literally, it was just like laws don't exist anymore. Like, we're drinking outside. We're smoking outside. We're having gay marriage outside. All of it is happening in this exact moment. And it was like the
very different than Capitol Hill right now.
the utopian world that we want to see all came together at once in this moment in 2012. It was an incredible moment.
I mean, so Rishop like just became such a massive song. I mean, you mentioned it, like first hearing Macklemore on Cube was like, oh, this is something. And then it was like Macklemore is on literally every radio station. Like, country stations were playing Macklemore. Like, Kixie.
Yeah, wherever white people were, they were playing Macklemore.
No, like, well, I mean, you know, it's Seattle radio, I think, everywhere.
Every station was playing Macklemore.
I mean, and I got to tell you, I put it on the playlist, but I don't know that I can listen to Thrift Shop again. But Can't Hold Us still holds up.
So, oh, yeah. I'm telling you, Can't Hold Us, Thrift Shop was important. Can't Hold Us changed things.
I mean, that song is like this touchdown song for the Seahawks for a long period of time.
I've got the sign. So The Heist came out that year, which was the Macklemore album. And he won the Grammy for Best Rap Album for The Heist. And like,
wrote some notes about it. And then
it's good.
We're going to get to those in a second.
It's good. He had a lot of guilt. Like, what we're talking about is literally maybe the best rap album that has ever been recorded came out in 2012. And spoiler alert, it's not The Heist. But I've got the CD version of, it's got the like crocodile like outline of it where it's like embossed, the crocodile embossed, signed by Macklemore across the top somewhere in the fucking garage or downstairs or whatever, where he sent it to me. And I was like, this is kind of cool, right? And it still is kind of cool.
I mean, look, whatever you think about Macklemore right now, like, that was such an amazing time. And no. I want to note a specific memory, which is, like, after I finished the last Pro Basketball Prospectus book we did in 2012, I remember, like, putting 10,000 hours on repeat and being, like, that was, like, my celebration for finishing that book.
It is a very good rap album. And ultimately, like, at that moment, he was an extremely important artist. There are other voices that I think are extremely important to recognize since then, and even in the year 2012. But like,
yeah, should we get to
Frank?
Whoa, is that where we're going to go next?
Well, tell me where we're going to go, because there are a lot of important records that came out in 2012.
I mean, what were you referring to as the greatest rap album of all time?
Yeah.
You were referring... Wait, what were you referring to?
Good Kid, Mad City.
Okay, that's what I assumed. Yeah.
But, I mean, possibly. It's up there. It's in the conversation.
That, like, it hit so hard out of nowhere. I mean, not out of nowhere, but, you know.
So, we talked about this before. He played Bummer Shoot, and I remember being pretty skeptical.
Skeptical?
wait, re-record that. I remember being pretty skeptical about Kendrick Lamar. Katie was like, Section 80 Kendrick Lamar, Katie was very into. And I was like, I remember being in Vegas, me and Ben and Katie and Mrs. Fantasy Genius. And Katie was just like, yo, Kendrick Lamar, the shit. And I was like, no,
nope. I was like pretty anti. I'm willing to admit it that I felt like Section 80 was just not my shit. And I heard Good Kid, Mad City, and from like there's the Shireen into Bitch Don't Kill My Vibe, and I was like, oh, okay, this is the most important rapper of our generation. You don't even need to get like you get to backseat freestyle, and you're like it's solidified, but. By the time you get three tracks in, it would be indisputable that Kendrick Lamar is the most important rapper of our generation. And it's like, there's other rappers who are more popular, Drake is more popular, whatever. Kendrick Lamar is at obviously another level, both skill-wise as a rapper, he's probably indisputably the best rapper maybe of all time, and then also as far as the message goes, again, maybe the best rapper of all time. Like there've been rappers who have been more fun than Kendrick Lamar. But beyond that, it's really hard to dispute what he is doing. And if there was anybody who is carrying on the legacy of somebody like Tupac, it is Kendrick for sure, 100%.
It's hard to believe he used to be jealous of Aaron Aflalo.
And the Aaron Aflalo, 100% Aaron Aflalo references. The most Aaron Aflalo references. But that's what makes it tight. Like, when he said that, when he's like, I used to be jealous of Aaron Aflalo, you're like, hell yeah, Kendrick. You're like, that's the real shit. That's what I want to hear, right? Like, I want to hear what it felt like to be there in Compton in the, whatever, year 2008. Something like that. Like,
was it earlier than that? Because Aaron Aflalo was in the NBA in 2008.
Was he?
Remember seeing him at All Star Weekend that year.
He was like when he raps. I used to want to be Aaron Aflalo though.
I gotta say where I saw Aaron Aflalo at All Star Weekend though.
Where?
It was at the Popeyes in New Orleans.
Damn. Number one chicken sandwich too. But when he raps, I used to like when you hear that when you're I mean. Good Kid, Mad City, every single song is incredible. But when he raps, I used to want to be Aaron Aflalo, you're just like, God damn, Kendrick. It's like, you're so far beyond the rest of us. You know? Like, this is a rap album that is incomparable to basically any rap album that has ever existed. And I remember when the Seahawks won the Super Bowl, spoiler alert, for the next year. We were listening to Money Trees drinking, oh my god, what's that cinnamon sugar liquor?
I thought I was drinking Skittles and champagne.
Oh, no, no, or we're not talking about Katie's house. We're talking about when we went to the fucking SeaTac.
I'm not sure, I wasn't partaking by that point.
You weren't? Oh, Fireball. We were drinking Fireball, and it was like, we were in the South Side. Look, there's Katie's house and there's the South Side. They're different places. And people were passing around the fifth of Fireball. There was like a quarter of it left. Maybe we'll talk about this later. Maybe we'll talk about this next year. But Money Trees by Kendrick Lamar was playing. The Fireball was being passed around. And I remember it was passed to me and I was just like, I'm drinking all of this. I'm drinking a quarter of the bottle. I was like, the Seahawks won the Super Bowl. Money Trees is playing. There's no better moment that's coming. And I slept in a dog bed that night. But there is no better moment.
An infant child at that time.
Yeah, fuck that. I slept in a dog bed. I don't care. The Seahawks won the Super Bowl. And I drank a quarter of a fifth of Fireball. Two Money Trees by Kendrick Lamar. Look, I've had about 1,000 children since then. And the Seahawks have not won the Super Bowl since then, so thank you.
Indisputably facts. Accurate.
Oh my god.
Should we talk about Channel Orange?
God damn. 2012 really hits.
It's weird because like I was going along in 2012 and I was like, wait, there's no good music this year. And, wow. Like, then all of it was released in the back half of the year for some reason?
Oh, Channel Orange was not the back half of the year. It was June. But
all right, fine. Channel Orange was the one that was already on the list. Uh, I don't know if I talked about this last year with Watch the Throne, but like for a period of time, every year there would be one album that I would repeatedly listen to when I was writing at that point the book and then eventually the just player profiles from it for ESPN. And Channel Orange was that during the summer of 2012. I listened to it literally every single day I wrote.
I don't...
You don't what?
I listened to Channel Orange when it came out pretty much nonstop. So there was first, there was a message from Frank where he was just like, I'm not... I am a gay man, basically. Where he was like, it was like iPhone message at the time, like 2012, where he was like, my first love was a man. And you see that and you're just like, what is going on? Right? Because like, this was the era of hip hop where that wasn't common in 2012. I mean, this wasn't a normal thing to see.
His Macklemore address in Same Love.
Let's actually not invoke Macklemore when we're talking about Frank talking about Channel Orange, but yes, like this was Frank as a young, cool black man is so different than Macklemore and his co-opting the culture or whatever. This was Frank being like, my first love was a man.
Making the point that he said, I would think hip hop hates me in that song. That was the point I was making.
There's a big difference, but it's okay. When I read that, I was just like, I read through the iPhone notes that Frank put out, and it was like, oh,
shit. What an era for iPhone notes.
Oh, shit. Dude, iPhone notes are undefeated 2012 through 2019, maybe. But like reading that, I was just like, damn, Frank. Okay. I was like, I like Nostalgia Ultra, but this is the most important artist from our generation. And consistently, like, I remember so many moments from that summer where it's like, Channel Orange is all that I care about. It was like Pink Matter, Forrest Gump, oh my God, Pyramids.
Yeah.
It was like, when he talks about Pyramids, like, as a person who's been to Vegas where he's like, she's working at the Pyramid at night, I was like, oh, Luxor, that's pretty tight. And then he breaks it down and he like goes through the like parts of the car. You're just like, Frank Ocean is on such a different level than every other artist recording music. There's literally no way that a human being can record more important music than Channel Orange. Until, of course, Blonde came out, which made somehow Channel Orange sound bad. But like, he was so far beyond what anybody else was doing. You know? Like, we talk about now what Tyler the Creator, whomever, is doing in mainstream pop music. Frank Ocean in 2012 was where everybody else is in 2020. Like,
yeah.
It, Channel Orange is... It's not my favorite Frank Ocean record. I still am. I'm a Blonde stand, but like,
it is my favorite.
And Channel Orange is like the pop version of Blonde, but like, he gets denser. He gets a little bit more outsider when it comes after that. But like, there's songs on Channel Orange where like, when we're done recording this podcast, I'm just gonna plug these headphones into my phone and I'm going to listen to them. I'm going to listen to Lost, right? And it's going to sound incredible. What Frank Ocean achieved on Channel Orange is what basically no other artist has achieved before or since then. We're talking like on the comparable level of like, this is his Blonde on Blonde or whatever. Like, this is at the level of the most important records that have ever existed. But this and Good Kid, Mad City came out in the exact same year is insane.
Anything else we need to discuss 2012 music?
God, I'm just...
Frank.
He just gets better. How does that happen?
I feel like we can move pretty quickly through the other aspects of it. TV, Veep debuted in 2012, if you want to talk about Veep.
So good. Can I just say Bad Religion is just like, I have to come back to Channel Orange. Bad Religion is like, when you hear that and you're like, you read the note from talking about, he's like, my first love was a man. And then you listen to Bad Religion and you're like, I can project out all the feelings they are expressing from this. Just like, it set up the next decade of music. So Veep. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Person from Seinfeld.
Oh.
Oh, the new adventures of old Christine person.
That's what I think of.
No, dude.
Occasional Curb ghost star.
Veep is incredible. The cast, Gary Cole, Jonah from Veep, right? Tony Hale, like the rest of the cast. I feel like they really struggled with, because politics became pretty questionable by the end of it. Like, politics wasn't a fun thing to discuss by the end of Veep, but the like vulgarity of Washington, I think they did a very good job of encapsulating it in Veep.
Any movies you want to talk about from 2012?
I mean, you have Django Unchained listed, which I watched recently. The Rick Ross verse. What is the song called? It's called like 100 Coffins or whatever. I thought that movie was incredible.
100 Black Coffins.
100 Black Coffins. I thought the movie in general, and then Tarantino working with Leonardo DiCaprio for the first time, as far as a long, dense film, that was very exciting. It's not Channel Orange, though. Who cares?
Arts of 2012. Should we come back to the beer?
Sure, what do you think?
It was interesting because the black lime is, it's a little bit sour, but not really sour. Not enough to detract from things.
Not enough to accent some things.
Your feelings about sour beers are well known. And wrong.
I don't know. It's impossible to compare it to.
I think I might go with the Rainier here.
Sure, great. Rainier, yep.
All right. Well, on that note.
Thanks so much for listening. Thanks so much to Infrared for joining us tonight and having a really great conversation with us. It was awesome to have him on and hear his perspective. And sad that he couldn't join us to talk about 2012, because I feel like he might have had some thoughts about both The Heist and Good Kid, Mad City, and potentially even Channel Orange. So we'll ask him. We'll be sure to have him on soon and ask him about his feelings about those records and more.
He's promised to listen to this podcast as soon as it's out, so I'm sure we'll hear from him. And remember to give us your feedback about what we should do going forward with Let's Remember Some Years or replacement features. Thanks for listening.
Thanks.